stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Hundreds of thousands marching in France in support of liberty after days of terrorist violence. And searchers have found, but not yet recovered, the black boxes of a downed flight. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. French President Francois Hollande briefly led hundreds of thousands of people through the streets of Paris today in a massive demonstration showing solidarity with the victims of a terror spree last week that killed 17 people. Heads of state from Europe, the Middle East, and Africa linked arms to form a human chain with Mr. Hollande as crowds swelled behind them at a unity rally. Crowds of the demonstration chanted for solidarity and freedom of speech. French officials have called the January 7th massacre at the Paris offices of the satirical weekly magazine Charlie Hebdo and a series of deadly acts that followed terrorism. French police also announced today a gun that was used to hold up a kosher grocery store in Paris on Friday was the same used in an assault that seriously wounded a jogger 2 days before. The gunman was killed when police stormed the market, as were the two other gunmen from the magazine attack. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder also announced today President Barack Obama will invite world leaders to Washington next month for a summit on countering violent extremism. A 10-year-old girl is the suspect in a suicide bombing at a crowded market in Maiduguri, Nigeria. Nigerian officials say the explosion killed at least 16 people and wounded 20 others. A police officer told Reuters news agency explosive devices were wrapped around the girl's body. A witness at the explosion told the French news agency the blast happened as she was being searched at the entrance to the market. Lebanese officials say a series of suicide bomb attacks on a cafe in Tripoli have left at least 9 dead and 37 wounded there. Witnesses say two bombers set off explosives at the cafe in the predominantly Alawite neighborhood. This is VOA News. Pakistani authorities say an oil tanker speeding in the wrong direction struck a passenger bus head-on early today, killing at least 57 people near the southern port city of Karachi. A senior police official said the collision occurred along a stretch of bad road engulfing both vehicles in flames on impact. The victims include women and children, most of them burned beyond recognition, and officials say the death toll could rise. 2 weeks after Air Asia Flight 8501 crashed into the Java Sea with a loss of 162 passengers and crew, searchers believe they've located the flight data recorders and the main fuselage. Ron Corbin reports the wait now is for better weather.
Officials from Indonesia's National Search and Rescue Agency said sonar had detected an object measuring 10 metres by 4 metres, raising hopes the aircraft's main fuselage had been located. Search teams working off the coast from the West Kalimantan town of Pangalan Bun have sought the wreckage in water up to 30 metres deep, but are facing very low visibility due to large amounts of silt stirred up by strong currents. Saturday, crews raised the aircraft's main tail section to where the flight data recorders are stowed, but search teams say the recorders had become detached from the aircraft. Divers hope calmer waters Monday will let them find and retrieve the black boxes and fuselage. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in India today at an international investment conference where he's promoting economic ties with the South Asian nation ahead of a visit by President Barack Obama later this month. Mr. Kerry arrived earlier leading a U.S. delegation to the Gujarat Investment Summit, which seeks to promote responsible, sustainable development. The top U.S. diplomat will also meet with Prime Minister Narendra Modi to discuss plans for Mr. Obama's visit to participate in India's annual Republic Day ceremonies. In an address at the summit today, Mr. Kerry discussed bilateral and global trade issues.
We share Prime Minister Modi's goal of increasing our country's annual trade fivefold in the years ahead, and we want to expand our commercial ties and change the way our businesses talk with one another.
Kerry also stopped briefly in Germany on Saturday and met with the Sultan of Oman. There is positive international reaction to reports of rival factions in Libya agreeing to hold talks in the coming days in a push to end a deadly four-year security crisis. A UN statement Saturday said a meeting of opposing factions will take place at UN offices in Geneva and focus on the formation of a unity government and the development of a permanent constitution. The statement did not offer details further, but France, Germany, Britain, the U.S., Spain, and Italy have issued joint statements praising the development. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
I'm pleased to say that the Independent National Electoral Commission is adequately prepared to conduct the general elections in February.
The chairman of the Nigerian Electoral Commission promises to organize a credible general election scheduled to be held in February.
It's great concern for all of us Cameroonians and particularly for elected officials, because you understand that when a country is attacked as we are,
a Cameroonian lawmaker says parliament will demand government to outline security plans to protect civilians following recent Boko Haram attacks.
The first phase of testing means giving vaccine to healthy volunteers in areas where the virus is being transmitted, and this is to actually test whether they work.
And the World Health Organization announces another round of trials as part of a process to come up with an Ebola vaccine. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The chairman of the Nigerian Independent National Electoral Commission, or INEC, says the electoral body is adequately prepared and committed to ensuring the February general election is credible and devoid of violence. Professor Atahiru Jiga told me that Nigerians would see a significant improvement over previous elections due to INEC's effective planning ahead of the vote.
I am pleased to say that the Independent National Electoral Commission is adequately prepared to conduct the general elections in February. We have used the last 4 years to plan and to execute those plans in preparation for the elections. And we've introduced many additional new things that can add to the integrity of the electoral process. So I feel confident that we are now adequately prepared to do the 2015 general elections and to make it much, much better than the 2011 general elections.
You talked about winning the confidence of the electorate or prospective voters in Nigeria. How do you intend to do this so that Nigerians will repose confidence in the ability of the Electoral Commission to administer a credible vote, devoid of what some people say is election engineering, bias towards one party or another?
We believe that to earn the trust and confidence of the people, we have to protect the integrity of the Electoral Commission. We have to ensure that it is nonpartisan, it is impartial, and under any circumstances, it provides a level playing field for all contestants. So we've paid a lot of attention to designing policies and to execute policies with adequate mechanisms that can ensure that with regards to operational and logistics of the conduct of election, we are efficient and also our staff exhibit the necessary professionalism that is required. But it also requires a lot of training and retraining. I must say that we have benefited remarkably, tremendously from many development partners in order to raise that level of professionalism and competence of our staff.
If I may ask you, people are expressing concern about the security in the country. Boko Haram, as we know, has stepped up attacks on innocent civilians in various parts of the country. In some areas, they are even controlling some areas in the country. Will elections be held there? And what is the cooperation with the security agencies to bolster security to protect these voters?
There is absolutely no doubt that there are security challenges in some parts of our country, and that there are concerns as to whether elections could hold in those areas or where insurgency has been stepped up, as you said. in particular the three states of Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe. We, as an election management body, have been working very, very closely with the security agencies to understand and analyze the situation and to be able to rely on their advice as to what levels of security arrangements are necessary to be able to conduct credible elections in those areas. I can say that we, as an election management body, in terms of operations and logistics, we are preparing to conduct elections everywhere in Nigeria. But to deploy for the election, we have to rely on the advice and the support of the security agencies in these three states that are under emergency. So all I can say is that we are hopeful and we are also prayerful that we will be able to conduct elections everywhere in Nigeria in February of 2015.
How are you coordinating with international observers who will come to monitor the elections, especially when people want to see what the assessment is when they monitor the poll?
INEC believes very strongly in encouraging observers to come and observe our elections. We have guidelines and we have a system of registration and accreditation for all foreign and domestic observers. And as many of them as meet these requirements are accredited. So we have benefited from the reports of international observers, those who observed the 2011 election, general elections, and gave us their reports. A lot of the reform measures we introduced to improve the process were drawn from the reports that we got from independent observers. So we appreciate the effort of those who find time to come and observe our elections, but we urge them to respect our rules and regulations, because the major concern about election observation is some may tend to be intrusive or even may tend to interfere with the process. So long as people come just to observe and to write reports and to give reports to us so that we can learn from those to improve, they are welcome.
Professor Tairo Jiga is the chairman of the Nigerian Independent National Electoral Commission, or INEC. He spoke with me from the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Still in Nigeria, Saturday marked 1 week since Boko Haram seized the far northeastern town of Baga and began raiding nearby villages. Local officials say militants killed hundreds of civilians and razed entire communities. And Luke has the story reported for VOA by Karim Haruna in Maiduguri, where thousands of Baga residents fled.
Baga fisherman Yahya Takakumi spent 4 days running and hiding in the bush after Boko Haram militants seized the town January 3rd. He says, "I have not seen four of my children and my elder brother. Some people said they saw my brother near the village of Dabanshata the day after the attack, but I now fear for his life, because only God can say the number of persons that were killed in the Dabanshata area." He walked with one of his wives and his other children to the state capital, Maiduguri. Boko Haram seized the town of Baga from Nigerian troops stationed at a multinational military base there. Survivors told VOA that soldiers ran out of ammunition and had to flee for their lives. They said insurgents blocked the roads out of town and then pursued residents fleeing into the bush. Some residents took canoes across Lake Chad or tried to swim. Takakumi says the killing went on for days in surrounding villages. He says scores of people were killed around Lake Chad. He says Boko Haram blocked the boat pass. He says any boat or canoe that came along, they killed the occupants. Several thousand people from the Baga area fled southwest to Maiduguri. At least 7,000 more fled in the other direction, into Chad. The senator for Northern Borno State told VOA he knows of at least eight other towns or villages around Baga that had also been raided and torched in the past week. Local officials say they do not know the death toll for now. Cell phone communications are cut. Boko Haram controls the area. A Nigerian government spokesman said Friday that security forces backed by airstrikes are battling to get it back. In Maiduguri, the state government has put up displaced Baga residents in newly built teachers' quarters. The federal government says it is providing assistance for 2,000 people there. The local vigilante group, the civilian JTF, keeps watch at the camp and said Friday that they had arrested three suspected Boko Haram members hiding among the IDPs. One of them, a 27-year-old named Garba Mohammed, told VOA he took part in the raid on Baga and then fled. He said Boko Haram forced him and 40 other young men to join last year. His face looked ragged and distressed as he spoke. He says Boko Haram rounded them up at a mosque in Baga. Boko Haram threatened to kill them and their families if they didn't come. He says they were drugged at the camp, and then he was forced to kill or be shot by his commander. He says he has killed six people. He said he was finally able to escape in the confusion when Boko Haram raided Baga last week. The civilian JTF says it continues to investigate. Human rights activists say Boko Haram has forcibly conscripted hundreds of young men and abducted hundreds of women and girls in the past year. Anne Luck, VOA News, Dakar.
Cameroon lawmakers will demand that President Paul Biya's government outline a detailed security plan to prevent the frequent attacks on civilians by the Nigeria-based Islamist militant group Boko Haram. Member of Parliament Joseph Banajem says the demand will be made when the legislature reconvenes in March. Banajem told me that the lack of infrastructure in parts of the country's north could hamper security agencies' ability to respond rapidly to Boko Haram attacks in nearby villages.
Surely, we did raise it in the last session, and when we come back in March, because our next session is in March, when we come back in March, we have to raise it because it's great concern for all of us Cameroonians and particularly for elected officials, because you understand that when a country is attacked as we are, much of the resources that ought to be used to bring development and other activities are now diverted, you know, for war and for riposte on Boko Haram. So it's a great concern to every person and particularly to us elected officials. So we will have to raise it and see government reaction of how our forces are reacting to. There is great concern from all the actors around, and we are insisting that we need to do a little bit more in order to tackle the issue of Boko Haram, which is what we have been saying in the past, because the northern part so far has been neglected, and we think that it is time to really get on to, you know, to develop the area by constructing roads, by doing things which should bring the population closer to each other, and the way our reaction would be faster than what we have at the moment.
Honorable Banajem, some government supporters are saying that the recent airstrike ordered by President Paul Biya is one indication that the government is serious about combating these terrorists from Boko Haram. Others are saying that the government should do more. What group of thought do you belong to?
I think if the airstrikes can solve the problem of Boko Haram, definitely it would be necessary to engage in something forceful, because we are not going to be doing, you know, seek and hide with terrorists. I think we admit, everybody admits that this is a terrorist group. And nobody can condone any terrorist activity because it disturbs society and the functioning of society. So government, the government should, if the airstrikes and more of it can help to solve the problem of Boko Haram, they should be engaged. But I want to say that there is a lot of reflection. I'm coming from a constituency where people are very alert. And many of my constituents are asking the question, what is the Nigerian government doing? How is their reaction to the Boko Haram phenomenon? Because if Cameroon is striking hard and Nigerians are not doing the same, because we would harm Boko Haram if both governments were striking them at the same time and harming them together, we could come to terms with it as early as possible. So while Cameroon is striking hard, we would expect Nigeria to do the same, so that, like I believe from the U.S., where you are, anything about terrorism, any civilized person should say that if there is a way of striking hard on terrorists and terrorism, we should do that.
Lawmakers I spoke to in Cameroon are saying that there's need for the government to outline in parliament a detailed plan or its policies to combat this Boko Haram and ensure security is improved. What do you say to that?
We have been pressing our government to get all the stakeholders on board and involve every person who can give information, who can act in a way that our activities should be fruitful.
Joseph Banajem is a member of the Cameroonian Parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. The World Health Organization, or WHO, reports phase three trials of possible Ebola vaccines are set to begin at the end of January and early February in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Experts who attended a high-level WHO meeting on Thursday reviewed data from clinical trials on three potential vaccines and agreed they were safe and could proceed to the next phase. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Manufacturers have been fast-tracking the development of Ebola vaccines in the past several months, and the speed and urgency with which scientists have responded to this critical need appears to be paying off. WHO Assistant Director General Marie-Paul Kini says two vaccines developed by Merck and GlaxoSmithKline have undergone the first phase of clinical testing, which looks at the safety of the vaccines and the immune response against the Ebola virus. She says both vaccines have proven acceptably safe, so trials for these two vaccines will begin in a few weeks to test their effectiveness.
The phase three trials of the two lead vaccines, the third phase of testing means giving vaccine to healthy volunteers in areas where the vaccine, where the virus is being transmitted, and this is to actually test whether they work. And we have already been informed of plans of a third manufacturer, Johnson & Johnson, to also engage into efficacy testing.
According to the latest WHO figures, the Ebola epidemic so far has claimed 8,259 lives and infected 20,972 people in the three heavily affected West African countries. The chair of the high-level meeting and professor at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa, Helen Rees, says unprecedented and remarkable progress is being made in the development of an Ebola vaccine. While this is encouraging, she says the epidemic is far from over.
Clearly, what we want to do is eradicate this virus. We don't want to have pockets of virus continuing and continuing. But for this reason, it's very urgent that we get into the field very quickly to do these clinical trials. Because if there are very, very, very few cases of Ebola, as you, I'm sure you understand, it's going to be difficult to test whether the vaccines work or not. So we recognize that we are going to push speed, but without compromising on quality.
The WHO experts estimate it will take about 6 months for results from the phase 3 trials to be known. They say the production of vaccines will go on while the trials are underway. They say they expect to have a huge stock of millions of doses of vaccine available by mid-year. In another bit of good news, they say the board of Gavi, a global health partnership that provides vaccines to poor countries, has approved funding for Ebola vaccines and for strengthening the fragile health systems in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Uganda is scheduled to host the 10th Africa Symposium on Statistical Development in the capital Kampala on Tuesday. At the conference, Ugandan statistician Professor Ben Chirejere will launch his book titled Emerging Data Revolution, Strengthening the Statistics, Policy and Decision-Making Chain at a conference in Kampala. I reached Professor Chirejere via telephone link up to talk about the impact of his book in Africa.
This book is about to a data revolution in Africa that is meant to strengthen the statistics, policy, and decision-making chain. The UN has recommended that all countries should start a data revolution to support the post-2015 Sustainable Development Agenda. And fortunately for Africa, in the last 10 years or so, we have been able to put in place structures and strategies and really systems which we think will help us to deliver a data revolution in Africa.
Professor Kirijira, what is the status of statistics in Africa at the moment?
I can say that in the last 10 years, we have had a tremendous improvement in statistical development in Africa. One example is that we have had close to 50 African countries participating in the current UN round of population and housing censuses. Now, these censuses are undertaken every 10 years. In the last round, we had about a third of the countries in Africa actually not participating in the census. That means that we have made a tremendous job in the census taking.
With your book, do you think policymakers in Africa would benefit or would embrace it to enhance their work about planning effectively?
The book is mainly meant to help data producers to really guide them on how to improve statistics and how to sustain the improvements that have already been made. But also it helps them to better advocate for statistics, including advocacy for use of statistics for planning and decision-making, but also advocating for resources to improve statistical systems in Africa.
Professor Ben Chirajira is a Ugandan statistician. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, January 11th. It's just 6 days to the kickoff of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations. The tournament will be held in Equatorial Guinea, an emergency replacement for Morocco, which dropped out over Ebola fears. Apart from the host, which is an automatic qualifier, there are 15 other teams in the three-week tournament that will run through February 8th. For the first round, the 16 finalists are divided into four groups, each comprising four teams. Here are the groupings. Group A hosts Equatorial Guinea, Burkina Faso, Gabon, and Congo. Group B, Zambia, Tunisia, Cape Verde, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Group C, Ghana, Algeria, South Africa, and Senegal. And Group D, Ivory Coast, Mali, Cameroon, and Guinea. At the end of the first round, which will be played in a round-robin basis from January 17 to 28, the top two teams from each group will advance to the knockout stage. Four stadiums in Equatorial Guinea will host the matches. They are the 36,000 capacity Estadio do Bata in the port city of Bata, the country's largest stadium. The 15,000 capacity Estadio do Malabo in the capital city, the 10,000 capacity Estadio do Mongomo in mainland Equatorial Guinea, and the 5,000 capacity Estadio do Ebebiyin in the northeast. The opening and the second matches, featuring Equatorial Guinea against Congo and Burkina Faso against Gabon, will be played in Bata on January 17. The Bata Stadium will also host the final on February 8th. The 16 qualifiers have continued their final preparations for the tournament. As part of the preparations, several teams have been playing friendly matches. One of them is Bafana Bafana of South Africa. The team played 1-1 against Cameroon in the Gabonese capital of Libreville on Saturday. Vincent Abubakar powered Cameroon into the lead in the 7th minute, and the lead was maintained right through the interval. Substitute Sibusiso Vilakazi leveled scoring for Bafana Bafana in the 77th minute. The South Africans will continue their preparations for the Nations Cup with another friendly against Mali on Wednesday. Also on Saturday, Burkina Faso recovered to trounce Swaziland 5-1 in a friendly game in South Africa. The Stallions of Burkina Faso finished runners-up in the 2013 Cup of Nations in South Africa. Swaziland, which failed to qualify for the 2015 Nations Cup, shook the Burkinabe by taking an early lead through Nthunzi Nkonto. But the West African team rallied to lead 2-1 at halftime and then completed the tally in the second stanza. And in Casablanca, Morocco, Senegal defeated Gabon 1-0 in yet another friendly on Friday. Both teams are preparing for the Nations Cup. Fenerbahce striker Moussa Sow scored the only goal from the penalty spot in the second half. Away from the Nations Cup, Egyptian arch-rivals Al Ahly and Al Masry played 1-1 on Saturday in their first clash since a 2012 game that ended in deadly stadium riots, leaving 72 people dead. The match was played behind closed doors and at a neutral venue in the Red Sea city of Guna, far away from Port Said, where the riots erupted after the match on February 1st, 2012. 72 of Cairo-based Al Ahly's hardcore supporters, known as Ultras, were killed in the post-match violence in Port Said, home city of the Al Masry team. Before Saturday's match began, Al Ahly players wore black t-shirts to commemorate the deaths of their fans and avoided exchanging greetings with the Al Masry team, according to the French news agency, AFP. Families of those killed in 2012 had called for Al Ahly to boycott the match, but the club's management decided to go ahead with it. Since 2012, Egypt's Premier League Championship has been split into two groups to ensure the two teams never played against each other, except potentially in the final, although that didn't happen. However, for 2015, the league has reverted to a single group, which brought the two teams face-to-face on Saturday. Since the riots, football fans have largely been banned from attending league matches in Egypt. However, limited number of spectators were allowed during international games, whether played by clubs or the national team. Finally, the 2014 Glow Cup Awards Gala, which celebrates the best in African football, was held on Thursday here in Lagos. Here is my report on the gala night. The highlight of the gala night was the announcement of Ivorian midfielder Yaya Toure as the 2014 African Player of the Year. The 31-year-old Toure thus becomes the first player to win the award four consecutive times. While former Cameroonian star Samuel Eto'o also won the award four times, only three were won in successive years. Here is how Toure's victory was announced, as well as his reaction to the historic achievement.
All right, let's stand up for the winner, ladies and gentlemen, winning it for a fourth year running. Yaya Toure, everybody.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, I want to thank Allah for all this achievement. You know, I've been very blessed all this year, you know. As well, I want to thank the football fans, the CAF with the president, and as well, all the guys, his committee as well. And the last, thank you to Africa. Thank you very much.
That was Ivorian midfielder Yaya Toure speaking after winning the 2014 African Player of the Year, the most prestigious individual award in African football. Coaches of national associations affiliated to African soccer's governing body, CAF, voted overwhelmingly to make Toure the winner. Toure got a total of 175 votes to beat Gabonese forward Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, who got 120 votes, and Nigeria's star goalkeeper Vincent Nyama, who secured 105 votes. The representative of the sponsors, Mrs. Gladys Talabi, also addressed the gathering.
The Glow Cup Awards has over the years been firmly established as the authentic platform to annually celebrate success stories in the African football. We are delighted by the keen competition in both male and female football on the continent. The quality of football on the continent is growing in leaps and bounds. We note with pride and a sense of fulfillment that one of the major contributory factors to the rising profile of football on the continent is the Glow Cup Awards. We are proud to contribute to the resurgence of a game from which our people derive their biggest passion. On our part in Globacom, we wish to reiterate our commitment to do more for African football.
That was Mrs. Gladys Talabi, Executive Director, Legal Services at Globacom. Now, let's quickly give a rundown of the winners in the other categories of the 2014 Glow Cup Awards. African Player of the Year, based in Africa, Fami Mubele Ndombe of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Women's Player of the Year, Asisat Oshoala of Nigeria. A double winner on the night as he also won the Youth Player of the Year award. Most Promising Talent, Yassin Brahimi of Algeria. Coach of the Year, Karadine Madoui of Algeria. National Team of the Year, Algeria. Women's National Team of the Year, Nigeria. Club of the Year, Anton Setif of Algeria. Referee of the Year, Papa Bakri Gassama of the Gambia. Football Leader of the Year, Moise Katumbi Chapwe. President of TP Mazembe of DR Congo. African Legend Award, Oryx Club of Cameroon, winner of the maiden edition of the CAF Champions League in 1964. This award created some emotion as the three surviving members of the club struggled to climb the stage to pick up the prize. Platinum Award, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, first president of Ghana, and Nigeria's president Goodluck Jonathan. And then CAF's finest 11, goalkeeper Vincent Nyama of Nigeria. Defenders, John Kasulula, DR Congo, Mehdi Benatia, Morocco, Stephane Mbia, Cameroon, and Kwadwo Asamoah, Ghana. Midfielders, Yaya Toure, Ivory Coast, Yassin Brahimi, Algeria, Fakhreddin Ben Youssouf, Tunisia, and Ahmed Musa, Nigeria. And forwards, Asamoah Gyan of Ghana, and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, Gabon. That report from the 2014 GloCaf Awards here in Lagos on Thursday wraps up this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Clote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Wasama penzi safari, ujana ni manji ya moto, walile naga zamani. Pili tumetoka mbali, omaratizo changa moto, tuvisa visa furani. Tatu kidonda chako kwangu maradhi, matu sonone kapo kwangu simanzi. Tatu kidonda chako kwangu maradhi, ogani sonone kapo kwangu simanzi. Kwa mahaba ulonipa, nimenongewa, vurugu patashika, ay, punguza kidogo, na mengine kadhalika, toto suna nielewa. Apo apo liposhika, ukiongeza kidogo, ni mwenzako taumia.
My sweetie, sweetie, number one. My baby, you are number one. My darling, number one. Roya mama, my sweetie, sweetie, number one. My baby, you are number one. Oh, roya mama, na wivu sikatai, mana uchungwa mapenzi na ujua, so sije kunilagai, kaja kuzama ukani zingua. Na wivu sikatai, mana uchungwa mapenzi na ujua, so sije kunilagai, mwenzio na ugopa. Now show me how they do. Gololo, ah, gololo, ay, gololo, tay, gololo, say, gololo, ah, gololo, ay. And show me how you do. Gololo, ah, gololo, ay, gololo, tay, gololo, say. Show me how they do. Gololo, ah, gololo, ay, gololo, tay, gololo, say, gololo, ah, gololo, ay. And show me how you do. Ah, 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 tay, ah, ay, po, ah, haga, ay, po. Now I touch it to lale.
Na
nasema siku hizi wala kuna fungate mapenzi hayana samani hivyo mwambie wanaopenda bachache wengi wanatamani wanaanzaga kwa tafadhali wakishapewa wanapotea nenda mwambie ajazari na dua njema na mwombea so asidanganywe na gari burutani na fedha mimi akanichukia akanishusha thamani penzi nalompenda kisa mvinyo na bia asidanganywe na gari burutani na fedha mimi akanichukia mwambie asisikie mapenzi moyo wangu naumia.
And that was our Sunday music spot from East Africa. I hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. At a time when Boko Haram, the Nigerian militant Islamist group, is spreading insecurity and instability in northern Nigeria with spillover effects in northern Cameroon, Niger, and Chad, the Nigerian political class is focusing its attention on the forthcoming February general elections. Now that the two major parties, the ruling People's Democratic Party, PDP, and the opposition party, the All Progressives Congress, APC, have chosen their presidential and vice presidential candidates, politicians are crisscrossing the country to campaign for their candidates. Last week, President Goodluck Jonathan kicked off his campaign for a second term when he spoke at the Tafawa Balewa Square in Lagos. Some commentators claimed that he made his best speech of his political career. Full of confidence, he stoutly defended his performance in all sectors of his administration. However, keenly aware of the general concern regarding the state of security and the inability thus far to target Boko Haram successfully, he must have surprised many when he blamed his predecessors for the ills of the nation, with specific reference to the current doubts effectiveness of the Nigerian army. He singled out Major General Muhammad Buhari, the opposition candidate, for significant criticism. He asserted that the retired general did not pay sufficient attention to the army while he was the military head of state. But after General Buhari had long retired, the Nigerian army performed well and played a credible and useful role in rescuing and saving Liberia and Sierra Leone when, as the major component of ECOMOG, the ECOWAS peacekeeping force, the West African sub-region was in acute crisis. Perhaps concerned that the APC might be endeavoring to make significant inroads in the southern political base of his party, President Goodluck Jonathan advised the APC not to bask in the euphoria of an endorsement by what he called a renegade faction of the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, MEND. President Goodluck Jonathan took up the ever-recording issue of corruption in Nigeria's political life, mentioning that none of his predecessors have been able to defeat corruption. He stressed that his administration had put in place structures to fight corruption successfully. He added that, quote, "It is better to prevent corruption than chase culprits," end of quote. But the overarching problem confronting preparation for the February election remains the threat posed by Boko Haram, particularly for those voters in the north. And this matter featured prominently at the briefing of the Security Council last week. The Secretary General representative in West Africa, Ambassador Mohammed bin Chambers of Ghana, did brief the Council. By and large, he expressed concern about the possible impact of the Boko Haram insurgency on the general elections. His briefing was accompanied by a surprise remark by Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to the press last Thursday. He stated that the presidential contest presented a, quote, "grave test," unquote, for Nigeria. He went on to point out that the counterinsurgency measures had thus far failed to provide protection for civilians. President Paul Biya of Cameroon has added his voice to all those calling on the international community to join the fight against Boko Haram. I thank you.
And thank you. That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America and from the rest of the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, Brian McCullier. We say a big thanks for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a doctor who invoked a storm on his people cannot prevent his house from destruction. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In support of President Barack Obama's climate action plan, the U.S. Energy Department recently announced two new efficiency standards. The new standards, which apply to fluorescent lamps and commercial ice makers, are the 9th and 10th standards finalized in 2014. Altogether, the 10 standards finalized last year will help reduce carbon dioxide emissions by over 435 million metric tons. The new standard for fluorescent lamps will help reduce harmful carbon dioxide pollution by 90 million metric tons, equivalent to the carbon pollution from the annual electricity use of more than 12 million homes, and save Americans more than $15 billion in electricity bills through 2030. The standard for commercial ice makers, which provide large volumes of ice that is typically used in soft drinks, ice water, and other beverages, and also to keep fresh fish, salad bars, and other products cold, will help reduce harmful carbon dioxide pollution by 4 million metric tons. This equipment is used in a wide variety of locations, including in hotels, restaurants and cafeterias, hospitals, schools, grocery and other retail stores, and office buildings. Since the beginning of the Obama administration, the Energy Department has finalized new efficiency standards for more than 30 household and commercial products, including dishwashers, refrigerators, and water heaters, which are estimated to save consumers nearly $480 billion through 2030. To build on this momentum, the U.S. is committed to continuing to establish new efficiency standards that, when combined with the progress already made through previously finalized standards, will reduce carbon pollution by at least 3 billion metric tons in total by 2030, equal to more than a year's carbon pollution from the entire U.S. electricity system. In November, the U.S. announced a target to cut net greenhouse gas emissions 26% to 28% below 2005 levels by 2025. As part of President Obama's climate action plan, the Energy Department set an ambitious goal of finalizing 10 energy efficiency standards this year. And with the new efficiency standards for general service fluorescent lamps and automatic commercial ice makers, we have reached that goal, said Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz. The Energy Department is committed to building on this progress and will continue to develop standards that move the U.S. closer to a low-carbon future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.